Then had they tunneled out the chamber behind it. You needed the strength of 4 oxen to move it, with the special equipment of pulleys and rope. Not even a troll would be strong enough to shift it. Nevertheless, it was with a feeling of unease that Ortgar strode through his simple palace, more a fortress than a royal residence in appearance. He reached the courtyard, swung himself up into the saddle, and rode up next to Meinart, the captain of the guard. "Off to Parister at full gallop," he ordered. The horses thundered out through the gate and down through the streets of Pendleburg toward the southwest. They raced along roads so narrow only 2 could travel abreast. To their right, the walls rose sheer to the skies, while to their left loomed the dark abyss, the edge of a precipice and long rocky slopes. Ahead, the sun shone on the far peaks and mountain pastures in an interplay of light and shadow. If you were to forget for a moment where you were riding, bewitched by the beauty of the view, you would be lost. Sudden death awaited the unwary. Their swift progress made constant vigilance essential. The captain sent an advance guard to ensure they met no other vehicles or riders coming suddenly round a bend on this treacherous path. They could lose some of their number to injury or death. If you fell from the saddle or from a wagon, the chasms of Ergon's mountains knew no pity. They crossed a narrow pass. Ortgar remembered his dream and looked back, prompted by some vague feeling. From here there was a good view back to Pendleburg, which lay bathed in picturesque light. In one of the rays of sunlight breaking through the white clouds, he caught sight of a metallic flash directly below the entrance to the palace. "Halt!" Ortgar ordered, reining his horse to a standstill and turning to get a clearer look. Again there was a dazzling spark, this time too bright to be coming from a helmet or reflected off a shield. Immediately he saw there was smoke rising from the palace. "We're going back!" The king's thoughts were with his capital city. "They're under attack! Our diamond is in danger! We'll take the enemy by surprise from behind!"
"Your Majesty, is it wise to return now in the thick of the attack?" objected Meinart. "Think of Prince Malin's message. If magic is being used, you should stay well away from the fighting. Send a scout to find out."
Ortgar would gladly have followed this suggestion, but was reluctant to show any weakness. In his dream, the creature had pursued him. Now it was time to turn the tables.
"It's only a creature, Meinart. It took the men of Golden Sheaf by surprise, but my soldiers are forewarned and ready. We will destroy it."
Ortgar thrust his spurs into his horse's flanks and raced back the way they had come. The place was in uproar. The townspeople were running around in the streets, pointing up to the palace, where smoke was pouring out of the windows. Many had armed themselves with buckets to help with the firefighting. Others carried swords and spears to go to the aid of the soldiers. News of the attack had swiftly made the rounds. With Ortgar at their head, the band galloped through the ruins of the main gate. The portcullis had melted out of shape, as if giant red-hot fingers had played with it. Smouldering torn-off limbs, charred spear shafts, and melted sword blades lay scattered in the courtyard. In places, blackened flagstones had crackled and split asunder in the intense heat.
"Our defences won't have been able to stand up to this,"
Ortgar said to Meinart, horror in his voice. He could not take his eyes off the blood-covered bodies. At dawn that very morning, he had talked and even laughed with some of these, his subjects, who now were reduced to mutilated corpses. Ortgar stifled a choke and trembled all over. Whatever it was that had done the killing had strength far beyond anything known in Gerdlegard in recent history, far beyond anything he himself had ever experienced. They followed a trail of destruction through the devastated central tract of the palace. Fire had broken out in several places. Ignoring the injured men lying moaning in agony, they raced straight down the steps to the cellar. The safety of the diamond was paramount. As the soldiers ran down the last steps to reach the lobby to the treasure vault, they heard a loud hissing sound and saw light flickering over the walls and the stairs. At the same time there came a beast-like roar and the cries of men in agony. A cloud of acrid smoke tumbled out of the vault toward them, so it was clear to every last man of them what was ablaze in the chamber. Ortger stopped. The trembling that had seized him was worse now. His body refused to move toward the ghastly scene where death was raging ferociously, taking its victims at will. Even if his spirit knew clearly what power and what value were inherent in the diamond they had kept watch over so well, nothing could have made the young king move a muscle now in its defense. The being that had visited him in his nightmare was now reality. With a loud crash, the rock burst apart, great boulders breaking off and tumbling down off the walls, landing at the king's feet. They heard triumphant laughter. There came the clank of iron, then two heads rolled over to the bottom of the stairway. "It's broken open the door of the treasure chamber! Palandiel, save us!" whispered Ortger in terror as he stepped backwards. "The stone is lost!" There was a dull thudding sound approaching the stairs, repeated at regular intervals like the footsteps of a giant. The light of the fire threw a long, broad shadow, which advanced toward them, growing in size and coming nearer and nearer until their own shadows were overwhelmed and swallowed up. The creature causing the monstrous silhouette soon followed, bent double because it was too large to fit into the passage. But this was not the figure he had seen in his dreams. This was something far, far worse. It was made of tionium, completely of black tionium. Arms and legs were 2 paces in length, the rump no less tall and as wide as 3 barrels of beer. The demonic metal head, shaped like a bull's, displayed fiery red eyes, and clouds of white and black steam rose from behind the visor. There was a mesh with indecipherable symbols covering the whole construction. These signs gave off an eerie pale green light, as if lowering in wait for an opportunity to blaze out. Arrayed all around the structure were shining blades with spikes dripping with poisonous liquid. The blood of the fallen soldiers could be seen adhering to nearly all parts of this hideous form. Ortger saw scraps of clothing and bunches of hair on the spikes. Minart grabbed Ortger's arm.
"May Palandiel protect us! Look at that! By its neck! Isn't that an elf rune?"
Ortger's eyes were not able to locate the spot. His terrified gaze surveyed the surface of the whole monster, but his mind refused to register the horror in its entirety. Whenever the creature set a limb in motion, it gave out a hiss, and somewhere in the center of the colossal black armor plating, a mechanical whirring, rattling, and clanking could be heard. Just one of the metal claws would have been able to encompass the heads of 3 men at once. Underneath the neck, there was a porthole of thick glass, through which a terrible but compelling visage could be espied, with fangs bared threateningly. For Ortger, this sight was more than enough. His quivering fingers opened of their own accord, and his sword clanked as it dropped out of his grasp to the floor, smashing onto the stone and sliding down the stairs.
"Away from here! We must get away!"
he stammered, turning in retreat. Suddenly the runes flared up and blazed with light. On one side of the metal figure, 5 holes opened in a horizontal line, horribly reminiscent of muzzles. Steam issued from these openings, and the soldiers standing near Ortger fell screaming to the ground. He himself felt only a sharp breath of wind shooting past his left ear. The bodies of the fallen had the feathered shafts of steel-reinforced crossbow darts sticking out of them. The vicious arrows had pierced the trunks of the guards standing at the front, and had been travelling with enough force to injure those standing in the second row. Minart, the captain, was among those slain. Now there was no holding them. The soldiers fled up the stairs, with Ortgar racing ahead of them all, pissing himself with fear. An experienced warrior would surely have given the order to man the battlements and dismantle the stonework to get missiles to hurl down at this creature. But the young king did not have the steady nerves needed for such leadership. Not after that dream. Not after this sight. He was more than willing to allow himself to be led to a horse and then to flee Pendleburg, to flee for dear life. There was nothing left of the earlier eagerness for battle he had displayed when they had been climbing the pass. Not until he was a safe distance away did he call his retinue to a halt and send two men back to the city to find out what had happened after they left. The reports they brought back were devastating.
"The diamond is taken,
Your Majesty." One of them confirmed what they had all feared.
"That creature just tore down the door and smashed its way in. It didn't take anything else. Your crown jewels are still..."
Ortgar silenced the man with a gesture and looked at the second of the scouts.
"They are saying different things about which way the monster went. Some say it went through the town streets and made its way to the mountains. The others say it vanished into thin air, Your Majesty. The fires in the palace have been put out now, and the injured are being cared for."
The king could smell the drying urine on his clothes. It brought back to him the sense of shame and reminded him of the cowardice he had shown. It had been all too human and understandable a reaction. This enemy did not look like the opponent Malin had described in his letter, apart from two details. Ortgar conjured up again the sight of that terrible face behind the glass, and he knew now what the illuminated symbols on the armor plate signified. Sorcery.
"We'll head out for Parisra again," he decided. "The rulers must be told that another of the stones has been stolen. It's vital the remaining jewels are put under much stronger guard."
He spurred his horse onwards.
"There is no time to be lost. It seems that there's someone in Gerdlegard who's adept at magic and crazy for power. Onwards!"
The troops started off at a gallop and raced along the same road for the second time that day. Ortgar did not allow himself another glance back towards his city of Pendleburg. He was too afraid of having disaster stare him in the face. Gerdlegard, Elf Realm of Alandur, late spring, 6241st solar cycle.
"You're up already, Tungdil Goldhand. I hope I'm not late with your breakfast."
The dwarf jumped. Although the friendly tones gave no cause for alarm, the greeting did not sound in any way threatening, only surprised and a little hurt. The elf must have seen the letter that he'd been working on all night. There was nothing for it but to seize the initiative.
"I'm used to getting up with the birds," replied Tungdil,
and turned to face Tiwalun, who had come in silently and was standing right behind him.
"I know knocking on a tent is difficult, but you might at least have tried."
"My apologies. The breakfast was intended as a surprise," said the elf, bowing, but never taking his eyes off the piece of paper. "So you found it?"
Tungdil was not sure what Tiwalun meant. Did he mean the letter itself, or the secret message it contained?
"Yes, my friend had put it somewhere silly."
He decided to employ some of the truth.
"It got wet, and then these lines started appearing."
He pointed to the pale blue symbols.
"I insist on an honest answer. What is the meaning of all this kobold-like secrecy? Your delegation's all over Gerdlegard. Are they spies? They seem to be. Don't try to lie, because I shall be asking Prince Lutasil."
Tiwalun looked at him intently, trying to see just how much he did or did not know.
"I could never lie to a hero who saved Alandor from destruction," he said earnestly. "The writing that becomes visible on application of heat has nothing to do with the dwarf people. I swear it by Sitalia."
"Then tell me what it says."
"I can't do that. Ask our prince. It's by his orders." He held out his hand for the paper. May I have it?
Tungdil folded it and slipped it under his leather robe.
I prefer to give it to Lutasil myself, he said amicably.
That way he could be sure that the elf prince would actually grant him an audience. Then he could ask him in person about all these goings-on.
Tiwulun made the face he might have made if an orc had asked for his hand in marriage.
As you wish, Tungdil Goldhand. He will be glad to speak to you.
The smell of fresh bread pervaded the tent.
Have some food. Then I'll take you and your friend on a tour of our land.
He bowed and went out, and some elves in less extravagant attire laid the table and served refreshments. Boindil appeared in his mail shirt as usual. Nose in the air, he sniffed noisily.
Doesn't that smell good?
He called enthusiastically. He was looking forward to his food and watched as the elves completed their preparations at the table before retiring.
Did you stay up all night and watch? He asked,
once he was sure they would not be overheard.
I was translating, Tungdil said, and went over to the table.
And? Urged Ihard. What are the elves written?
Tungdil told him about his short exchange with Tiwulun.
What he doesn't know is that I've translated part of the letter, but it doesn't help us with the secret. The rest is illegible, either because of the bathwater or else written in symbols I'm not familiar with.
He helped himself to a piece of bread, poured out some tea and put honey in it. The scent of cloves and cinnamon and two varieties of cardamom rose to his nostrils. The infused ingredients, in combination with the herbs and the milk, made an excellent spiced drink, he realized, after taking the first sip. Even though his whole body was crying out for beer, brandy, or any other alcoholic beverage, he did not give in to the craving. He stuck with the tea. Boindil watched him crossly.
Are you doing this on purpose, scholar? Keeping me on tenterhooks?
Oh, you mean the letter? Tungdil grinned. Sorry, I was miles away.
With the slice of bread in his hand, he looked round, as Ironheart was doing, for some juicy meat. It seemed that the elves didn't serve meat in the morning, so he helped himself to the boiled eggs.
What I could read was a recommendation, praising us as heroes and encouraging the greatest possible vigilance. The remaining words were, keep them from Lutasil and only show them the outsides, and then again, keep them away from our new buildings, and not longer than 4 orbits. After that, get rid of them with any old excuse. Say it's because of their bad manners.
He tasted one of the eggs and was surprised. Although he hadn't used condiments, it tasted of salt and other aromas. Boindil had noticed the same thing.
Wonder what they feed their hens on.
Who says they're hens' eggs?
The dwarf chewed more slowly.
I underestimated the dangers of this type of mission. Foreign food.
He sighed and swallowed noisily. He recalled the first meal he'd had with the Freelings in Trovegold. There had been the oddest of ingredients like beetles and maggot beer.
I reckon the instructions mean that the elves are only to show us selected places, and not to let us meet up with Lutasil. And that we're to leave Alandor very soon.
Tungdil nodded.
The mention of new buildings is bothering me. What is it about them that they want to keep hidden from us, and probably from the rest of Gerdlegard too?
Ironheart was displaying his old fighting grin, even if he no longer had that fire rage in his eyes like before. Apart from the sense of humour and the hair, he was exactly like his twin brother, the one who had died.
I get it. If they tell us to go right, we'll go left.
Handing them a reason for getting rid of us even sooner?
Tungdil took some more of the eggs, slicing them onto his bread and putting garlic sauce on top.
But they haven't read the letter, so they haven't got the instructions.
Tiwulun came creeping in here as silent as a mountain lion. I don't know how long he'd been standing behind me. I think he must have been able to read quite a bit of it, he said. We've got 3 orbits. During the days we'll do as they say, and at night we'll go out snooping. Get ready to manage without sleep."
"Slinking around like a perfidious elf," complained Boindil. "Never my strong point. I hope I don't muck things up."
"We'll have to fight them with their own weapons there," said Tungdil. "What choice do we have?" They finished their breakfasts calmly and did not let themselves be hurried by Tiwaloon when he came to collect them. Around midday they set off on the ponies again toward the interior. They rode through the peaceful, lush green woods, where dark thoughts had no chance. It was all simply too beautiful, even if there weren't any mountains, much lamented by Ireheart. The elf did not tire of eloquently listing the particular charms of the various trees they passed. It was as if he were trying to lull them into a sense of security with his long descriptions. And, if it had not been for that coded letter, he might have succeeded. As it was, Tungdil and Ireheart simply nodded. But they had a good look around, keeping an eye out for anything unusual. It didn't escape their notice that they never rode through mountain territory, always remaining in the forest, where you could only see about as far as an arrow might fly. Of course, they knew the reason. When Tungdil asked Villanoil about mountain ranges or perhaps less wooded hills, the elf looked mortified that the guests were tired of the unique marvels of the quiet forest glades of Alandor. He promised them an outing with a view for the following day. As darkness fell, they rode up to a brightly lit building that Tungdil and Boindil were already familiar with. They had been here before when they came with Andokai to ask the ruler of the elves for help in resisting the forces of Nodon. Mighty trees formed living pillars, holding up the thickly woven roof of treetops, 200 paces overhead. But the forest halls had changed radically since that first visit. The artistically fashioned mosaics of wafer-thin gold and palladium sheets that used to sparkle suspended between the tree trunks were missing. In their place now you saw giant paintings, compositions in various shades of white. Here and there, a randomly placed diamond shimmered in the torchlight. Where once there had been showiness and skilled craftsmanship, now there was a strange clarity in the work that impressed the dwarves just as much as its monumental nature.
"What have you done with all that other stuff?" Boindil found himself asking.
"Is one constrained to seek artistic expression only in one single vein for all eternity?" responded Tiwaloon. "We have hardly any visitors in our forest to see how often our tastes change, seeking subtle nuances and variety. Let us tell you, Boindil Doubleblade, that we have experimented with many different art forms over the cycles. As with your own people, 100 or 200 cycles are as nothing to us." He took a left turning and was attempting to lead them out of the tree hall when Ireheart pointed to a triangular white monolith standing where once they had seen Lutisil's throne. Guessing from this distance, the object must be at least 15 paces high and 7 in circumference.
"May I have a closer look, friend elf?"
"It is nothing of significance," said Tiwaloon, in an attempt to downplay the importance of what they had seen. "The meal will be waiting for us." Boindil had forgotten Tungdil's advice that they should pretend to follow the elves' suggestions in all things during the daylight hours. Boldly, he marched straight past Tiwaloon to inspect the three-cornered monolith.
"The eye of a stone expert is called for here," he announced. "My people are renowned as excellent stonemasons."
The elf swiftly overtook him and walked backwards in his path, shielding the object from his view.
"No, Boindil Doubleblade, I would ask you not to do that. It is a holy and revered object that may only be touched by us elves. You should not have been permitted to see it even."
Ireheart looked up the length of the elf's legs, slowly up along his body, till his gaze reached Tiwaloon's face.
"That seems very discourteous," he complained. "Your delegation is shown every inch of our land, but here I am not allowed to cast eyes on a stone." "It is a holy relic, didn't you hear, Boindil?
Tongdil interjected to save the day.
So why did he say it wasn't of any great significance?
Not of any significance for you, said Tiwaloon with a smile. A drop of sweat rolled down his forehead over that smooth, unblemished skin that would surely remain wrinkle-free and youthful for at least 100 cycles.
Please, turn around.
Elves revering stones? Grinned the warrior. Our peoples have more in common than I had thought. Aside from the type of things you like to eat, of course.
He turned around quite calmly and pointed to the passageway Tiwaloon had previously indicated.
This way, is it?
This way, confirmed Tiwaloon, sounding relieved.
He strode off before the troublesome dwarf could change his mind.
Thank you for showing such understanding, Boindil Doubleblade.
But of course,
grinned Ironheart, looking at Tongdil. Late evening brought a surprise for elf and dwarf alike. They were sitting with Vilanoil and Tiwaloon finishing the final course of a light but lavish supper when a messenger came in with a letter. On reading it, the elf looked at the dwarves.
Very worrying news, he said. Three of the diamonds have been stolen. King Nates has gone, and so have King Ortgers and King Malbalors. They're talking about dreadful creatures and dwarves, too, launching these raids.
He read out the lines that described just how these terrible deeds had been committed in each of the three kingdoms. The guests listened in horror. The attacks by the awful machines in the Red Mountain Range were mentioned.
Evil has taken hold, and is stretching out its claws to grasp total domination,
Tiwaloon finished.
We'll leave first thing, said
Tongdil, extremely concerned. In such circumstances, he would have to ensure that the stone Gandagar had entrusted him with, hidden away safely in the vault, was being properly guarded. He was frightened for Belindis, his wife, who wouldn't have heard the news. If these unknown raiding parties had found the stones in all these kingdoms and dwarf realms, then they would have no difficulty locating his own, deposited simply in mine galleries that were comparatively easy to enter. The only soldier left in charge was Belindis herself, and she would be hopelessly outnumbered.
But our mission,
objected Boindil, until he remembered that his friend had one of the diamonds in his possession.
Forget it, scholar. The ponies will carry us to your home like the wind.
Tongdil stood up from the table.
We don't wish to be rude, Tiwaloon and Vilanoil. We need to get some rest. The next orbits will be hard for us. Please give Prince Lutasil our warmest greetings. I assume we will see him very soon at the ruler's assembly.
Tiwaloon looked distinctly relieved to hear of their departure.
Of course, he will understand why you have to leave. I shall get provisions brought for you, so that you can set off as soon as you want.
He got up and bowed to them.
I would have wished for a calmer conclusion to your visit here in Alandur, but the gods are testing us.
He smiled.
You will have an important role to perform, will you not?
I could do without tests like this, replied Tongdil. But if my people and Girdlegard need me, I shall be there.
He strode to the door. Ironheart followed, a laden plate in his hand. Vilanoil and Tiwaloon watched them go. When the door had closed behind them, Tiwaloon reached for the wine and poured himself a glass full to the brim. He had seen the hidden instructions in the letter. That morning, the dwarf hadn't noticed he had been reading over his shoulder until alerted by the sound of his voice. This bad news could not have come at a better time, since it meant the unwelcome guests were leaving Alandor of their own accord. It had been a serious error letting the dwarves anywhere near the monolith. Any moment things could have got much worse. Tiwaloon raised his drinking cup.
Here's to you, Sitalia. I drink to you, and in honour of your purest of creatures.
Ceremoniously, he lifted the vessel to his mouth, took three sips, and then poured the rest on the ground as a libation.
May the Eoil one day return and take power.
Villanoil smiled. But there was something afoot that night. In spite of extreme tiredness, Boindil could not help going out on his own to inspect the white stone Tiwaloon had so adamantly insisted he should not approach. They would be leaving Alandor the following orbit anyway, so it would not matter if he was observed. What else could happen to him? They surely wouldn't cut off his head for it. Stealth didn't come easily to him. He wasn't good at it and didn't like it. He'd taken off his leather-soled boots and left off his chainmail shirt. Completely naked, that's how it felt. He'd made his way through the tree palace as if stalking a deer. It seemed not a soul was around. He had thought he would remember how to get to the hall, but he had soon lost his sense of direction. This would never have happened to him underground.
"Wretched bloody trees, they all look alike," he'd grumbled, taking the next corridor to the left.
At first, he had been delighted that there were no elf guards about, but now he was getting worried about it. This was the prince's residence, after all, and there should be servants all over the place. He bravely opened the nearest door and found an empty room. Starlight fell into the deserted chamber, and there were a few leaves on the floor. That was all. No clothes, no chests, no bed. Boindil continued through the palace, trying a few more doors. He did not find a single room with any sign of occupation. It was nothing but a refuge for ghosts. By chance, he happened on the great hall with the tall white monolith dominating the space. Although no torches were burning, the stone itself gave off a glow, as if it had stored up light during the day to release in darkness.
"So there you are,"
he grinned and stepped closer, circling the stone, to give it a thorough inspection. There was not a single join on it, not a scratch, not at least as far up as the dwarf could actually see. The white surface shimmered smooth as glass. Boindil stretched out a hand. When his skin came into contact with the stone, he was amazed how warm it felt. So it wasn't just storing up light, but also energy from the sun. This was new to him. Well, he was a fighting man, and never much good as a mason, but he'd never come across anything at all like this. It meant that they were mining new minerals here in Alandor, a completely different type of stone. Boindil was turning to leave when he saw that where he had touched the stone, there was now the mark of five black fingers.
"Bloody orc, bloody shit!"
He looked at his hand. It was clean. He tried wiping the stone with his beard at first, and then with a kerchief, but the marks on the stone would not shift. They stared out accusingly from the otherwise immaculate surface of the monolith. The size of the handprint desecrating the holy monument made it obvious that only a small-handed dwarf could have done this. There would be an outcry. With Tiwaloon's words ringing in his ears about non-elves touching the stone, he went hot and cold all at once. He ran back, shook Tungdil awake, and grabbed his things.
"We've got to get out of here," he whispered. "Something's up."
He slipped into his boots and put on his mail shirt. His friend struggled up.
"What's happened?" "I went off to look at the monolith, and there are no signs of life in the palace at all. They've only opened it up because of us."
He quickly related what he had seen in the empty rooms.
"And the stone is not normal. It shows marks when you touch it," he murmured. "Marks? You mean you did touch it?"
Tungdil was fully awake and alert.
"But you heard what he said." "Yes, I know it's holy, but I'm in charge of this mission, and if the dwarves are keeping things secret, I want to find out why,"
he said defensively, crossing his arms. Tungdil uttered an oath and got out of bed. The elves had at least one secret they were keeping. And this three-cornered white stone seemed to be tremendously important.
"Come on. Let's see if I can clean off the marks somehow."
He collected his armor to be on the safe side and took a bowl of water, a cloth, some soap, and some of the perfumed toilet water that had been provided. Perhaps they could sort something out. Boindil showed him how empty the tree palace was. The scholar looked at the deserted rooms. He agreed. Nobody had been living here in ages. There were more and more puzzles. As they made their way, it seemed as if the wooden passage walls were shifting to prevent them finding the monolith. The corridors had turned into a maze, and they were lost until Tungdil thought to cut tiny notches on the wall with his knife. No longer wandering around aimlessly, they soon found the great hall. The handprint had got darker still, or so it seemed to Ironheart. The marks would be on that stone for all eternity. Nothing worked. They tried soap, they tried rubbing, they tried the perfumed water.
"It's no good," said Tungdil, throwing the cloth back into the bowl with a splash. "The stone is insulted because it has been touched by somebody that is not an elf." "What do you think? Should we tell Tivulun and own up, or should we make a run for it?"
Tungdil thought about it. If the elves had been a bit friendlier and more open, then he certainly would have chosen the honest course, to speak with Tivulun and ask for clemency for Boindil. But their hosts had been behaving strangely, and anyway, he had to get back to protect his diamond. Speed was called for. He dipped the soap in the water again and rubbed it between his hands until there was a good lather. Carefully, he lifted off the top layer of the soft soap with the blade of his dagger and pressed it onto the dark stains. It worked.
"You're the cleverest damned dwarf I know," whooped Ironheart.
After Tungdil had applied three thin layers, the ugly marks had been covered over. An innocent, superficial glance would not reveal anything suspicious.
"Right, that should do," Tungdil sighed with relief. "As soon as we have left Alandor, I'll send Prince Lutacil a letter apologizing. You will seek an audience and ask for clemency," he decided. His friend nodded. "So, it's off to the ponies."
The two dwarves found their way back to their quarters. Then they went to the stables and were off as fast as they could go toward the mines. Not until they crossed the border at dawn, when the ponies' hooves touched Goragar, could they relax. Nobody had pursued them. Girdlegard, Queendom of Wayern, Mifidania, 6241st Solar Cycle, Late Spring. When Rodario and Tassia had finished asking around the town after Fergus, they went back to the rest of the troop. A distraught Geyser rushed straight into their arms like a startled hen. Her plump body was bouncing all over the place, doing its best to escape from her dress. The tight bodice was unable to hold it all back.
"Master Rodario, at last you're back!" She took him by the hand. "Come quick! Some men came! Your caravan's been smashed to pieces and poor Raymar's been beaten up. Then we set the dogs on them and chased them off."
"All right, Geysa. Calm down."
He stroked her cheek. Rodario had been expecting something like this, and so could react sensibly. Nevertheless, it was upsetting to see how his home had been destroyed. The little house on wheels had suffered considerable damage in being ransacked for the necklace. If he set eyes on them, those heavies Nolik's father had sent, he'd skin them for all they were worth. He'd have the pants off them, underpants too, just to pay them back in humiliation.
"Oh, Palandiel!"
moaned Geysa in distress, staring at the mess from the doorway.
"How awful!"
Giving a sigh, Rodario sat down on the ripped-up mattress.
"Thank you, Geysa. It's all right. I'll tidy up later."
She nodded and left. Tassia closed the door and retrieved the necklace from under the floorboards.
"They're too stupid to do a decent search," she said, laughing with relief and putting the necklace on.
"And they think we've flogged the jewel in Mifidania," he added, holding out his arms to her. "Come here, Queen of the Stage, and grant the Emperor your favors. Display yourself in all your glory, with gold and jewels hung about your neck."
The dress she had pinched from someone's washing line slipped to the ground, and she lay down next to him, stroking his face.
"So,
Emperor of Lust. Shall we start work on your dramatic production?
Oh, that's daring. You'd like to make love on stage?
His grin was dirty, and his aristocratic face took on a vulgar leer.
We'd be thrown in jail, and no mistake, for indecency.
She smiled and tickled him with a lock of her blonde hair.
Let's do it anyway, right now. And just for ourselves.
He kissed the nape of her neck, and soon they were deep into their drama, until they sank back exhausted into what had been a mattress and covered themselves with what had been a blanket. After this delightful distraction, Rodario found his thoughts drifting back to his missing friend and to their current adventures.
Someone has tried to kill us. Good people have been lost, and a man has been carried off, he mused. And somehow, it's all connected with Fergus.
Tassia picked up the dark yellow dress and slipped it on.
Why? And what does anyone want with the blacksmith?
Lambus is a highly skilled craftsman. Others will be jealous of him. He put his own clothes back on, regretting that the girl was no longer visible in her exquisite entirety.
What if Fergus himself is behind it all? He wondered. Lambus told us he didn't want to leave town. What can have been so urgent that Fergus would have kidnapped him?
He dismissed the idea. That was not the way his friend would act.
Didn't you say he'd lost his partner and his children? She asked, standing up, leaning against the door. Perhaps he's found someone new. You mean the child he had with him?
Rodario started tidying the mess.
I don't understand. He loved Namora more than anything.
People's feelings change.
Sure, anyone else's, he agreed. Not with Fergus. You don't know him or you wouldn't say that. Only if he'd changed completely.
She had her hand on the door handle.
And what if it's not his kid? Perhaps he's just taken it in.
Tassia smiled at him.
I'd better leave you in peace to finish your sorting and your thinking.
Great. Off you go. She laughed winningly.
The Queen knows when she is not wanted.
And she stepped out.
Tassia!
Yes?
Rodario pointed at her throat.
The necklace!
Oh!
She ran her hand over the necklace that was catching the light so brilliantly.
It feels so nice against my skin.
Don't wear it while we're here in Methodania, he told her. She took it off, ready to put it back in the hiding place.
But later, we'll use it on stage a lot as a prop.
She blew him a kiss and ran out. He was left with the unwelcome task of restoring order in his domestic realm. That done, he sat down on the caravan steps with a lamp and wrote some more of the play. It came easily. Tassia and the events of the day were inspiring him. Everything they had been through found a place in the drama. It was full of passion, adventure, and secrets. How it was going to end wasn't yet clear. For that, he'd have to find Fergus first. He was pouring himself some wine from the only bottle to have survived when he heard Tassia's laugh. It was a very particular laugh. Jealousy flared up. He put the glass down and went over to Raymar's quarters. He stood on tiptoe outside the window and peeped through. Hearing that laugh had aroused his suspicions, and now he was sure. His queen of the stage was cheating on him. So, she was seeking entertainment elsewhere, and Raymar, that bear of a man, was assisting her, not completely selflessly, in her quest. Rodario returned to his narrow steps and picked up the glass. He laughed. He laughed and laughed until he was out of breath and inquisitive heads popped out of neighbouring caravans. Even Raymar came out, a towel round his middle to see what was up. The actor pointed at him and started laughing again, tipped over backwards, gasping for air.
All right, folks, he waved the observers away. It's only my normal attack of evening madness. It gets me whenever I hear another man making love to my woman.
Raymar blushed
and whizzed back inside his caravan. Rodario had hysterics again. He looked up at the stars, veiled now by a thin screen of clouds that had covered them in milk. "Oh, ye gods! That's some girl you sent me." He grinned. "She's paying me back for what I used to get up to with other women." He emptied his glass. "I'm wise to your game. Was it your idea, Samusin, god of justice?" he called out, raising his glass and saluting the stars. "I thank you! I've not been this inspired for ages." Cool, dark wine ran down his throat. He put the vessel down and started writing. Time sped by, but he was on fire. He cut bits out, wrote anew, and changed the wording of act after act, scene after scene. It was thirsty work. Without looking, he stretched out his hand for the bottle. There was a tinkle of broken glass, and the lamp he'd been using went out. He looked up in surprise. He couldn't have knocked it over. His hand had been lower. A mistake, it seemed. The lamp was still in the same place, just behind him to one side on the top step. Rodario stared at the arrow that had shattered it, and then buried itself in the wood. Half an ell to the left, and it would have got him straight in the eye. "The archer woman from Mithridania," he realized in a flash as he dived to one side, crawling under the wagon. He listened out. There were insects humming, the odd cricket chirping. The horses were dozing quietly in their temporary paddock, and Huey the grey and black hunting dog lay snoring in the grass, head on its paws. Altogether, it sounded like a perfectly normal night, apart from Tassia's faint moans, Raymar's loud groans, and the complaints from the overworked caravan springs. "Amazing. They are bonking their brains out while I'm the victim of an assassin." So ran his gallows humour as he looked at the wagon, where the girl and the workman were enjoying themselves so violently that the lamp swung to and fro. This had nothing in common with what he and Tassia had shared earlier. But what had she said? Sometimes a woman just needs a man with muscles. Flock! A second arrow landed close to him, hitting the wood. Then a third clanged onto the metal wheel hub and broke. He threw himself flatter still and stared out at the darkness being used for cover. He didn't want to wake the others. There was too high a risk that one of his troop would be injured or even killed, whether by accident or design. "Psst, you so-called watchdog," he hissed. "Psst, get up, hound!" The dog opened one eye and wagged its tail. "No, no wagging. Be a bad dog. Find, go get it. Fetch, bite." The hound got up and took a leisurely stretch, then trotted over to where Rodario lay under the caravan and licked his face. "Stop that!" The actor fended off these wet offerings of affection. "Kill!" He pointed over at the other side. "Fetch!" Huey had finally got it. He lifted his nose and sniffed, then, nose to the ground and tail straight out behind, he sloped off in the direction Rodario had indicated. The showman felt bad about sending the dog out. He peered out again, and soon could see neither the dog nor the assassin. And Raymar's wagon wasn't swaying any more. They'd had enough, then. A cold blade touched his throat.
"Disappear, you," said a rough voice.
The smells of cold smoke, rusted and heated metal, met his nose.
"First thing in the morning. Pack your stuff and scram. Take your painted wagon and be off. Out of here."
"May I ask?" He felt a sharp pain at the base of his throat, where the blade had cut into his skin.
"Get out of here, and stop asking questions about the Magister, got it?"
The voice whispered in his ear.
"We're watching you, showman."
Raymar's door opened a fraction, and Tassia looked out to see whether he was still sitting on his steps. Seeing him gone and the lamp extinguished, she flitted out of the caravan.
"Look at your fine mistress, showman. If you keep on trying to find Fergus, she will die," the man threatened.
His hair was grabbed and his head forced up and back until his forehead touched the underside of the caravan.
And then you, then the rest of your troop, then the Magister.
There was a further jab to his neck, this time a deeper cut. Something warm dripped down over his Adam's apple, and Rodario felt sick. He couldn't think of how to extricate himself. He was at the mercy of whoever it was crouched behind him, ready to kill with a movement of his hand.
Yes,
he croaked. Fear and the unnatural position made speech difficult.
Very good, laughed the stranger. Think about it. We're watching, right?
The hand let go of his hair, and he received a mighty blow to the back of his head, probably with the handle of the knife. It was enough to disturb his vision for a moment. He could hear the man crawl off, get up, and run. The danger was over. Groaning, Rodario struggled out from under the wagon, stumbled up the steps to his caravan, and then inspected the damage in a mirror. There was a red line all along the front of his throat. The cut was bleeding badly, and it was deep. It would be difficult to apply much pressure to the wound, but he made a linen pad and tied a scarf round to hold it in place. He'd go to some healer woman in the morning, after they'd struck camp and got away.
The adventure side is getting out of hand. Too much even for my taste, he murmured, checking the bandage.
Looking down at his fingers, sticky with his own blood, he started to feel giddy and sat down suddenly.
Much too much.
He dealt with the pain by drinking the rest of the wine from the half-full bottle. It was a good thing the archer woman had hit the lamp, and not the bottle.
Chapter 6 Girdlegard, Kingdom of Eidoslain, Early Summer 6241st Solar Cycle. Galloping ponies were seldom observed in Girdlegard. The thundering of small hooves did not really sound threatening, but together with the sight of the grim-faced dwarves in the saddles and the clattering of weapons and armor, it ensured that any pedestrian on the roads would rapidly make way.
Is it far now?
Oindil regretted they weren't using the tunnels, the easiest and quickest way to travel through Girdlegard. He was not particularly good on horseback, and he was feeling stiff. His back hurt with each jolt the pony made, and he seemed to have swallowed several flies.
You'll manage!
Tungdil showed mercy neither to himself, nor to the ponies, nor to his friend. It was obvious why he was in such a hurry. Apart from the life of his partner Belindis being at stake, there was a diamond that had to be saved. He knew that the stone was far more valuable than it appeared, rough cut as it was.
Only half an orbit still to go.
They heard hoofbeats from behind getting closer. A horse came up level with their mounts, but in the saddle sat not a human, but a solidly built dwarf. Axe handles jutted out of the saddlebags Tungdil could see bouncing up and down, and he could hear metal clanking. The dwarf was dressed in black and wore dark brown leather armor and heavy boots. The shape of his beard was eccentric, and there was blonde hair round his mouth and chin, but the rest of his face was shaved. Long, light blonde braids flew back with the wind. There was a black scarf covering his head. Tungdil recognized him at once.
Bramdil Masterstroke!
The other dwarf, considerably older, turned to him.
I know you,
he said loudly enough to be heard over the noise of the hooves.
Hilchester, wasn't it? They mistook you for me.
He pulled hard on the reins to slow his horse down.
And you were off to the Freelings. From what I hear, you made it.
They trotted along side by side.
Who'd have thought you'd turn out a hero?
He smiled and reached down a broad hand.
Good to meet you again, Tungdil.
Tungdil wasn't sure how he felt about seeing him again. It had been thanks to Bramdil,
that he had found the way to the Freelings and the city of Trovegold, Bramdel having given him the tip about the pond and the hidden entrance. But at the same time, Tungdil despised his trade.
Bramdel? The executioner? Selling body parts to the Longens? Asked Ireheart.
He sat up in the saddle.
Revolting! And thanks, it was your fault I ended up in that stinking water!
You must be Boindil Doubleblade, then,
Bramdel grinned.
Two heroes off on their next adventure.
And you'll be on your way to the next execution, replied Tungdil. He did not want to give out any information.
I'm riding to Parista. King Bruron pays well for my services. I'm training up his executioners.
He shrugged apologetically.
Afraid I can't stop for a drink and a chat. Got to hurry.
That means you'll be doing yourself out of work, grinned Ireheart.
Yes, but I don't care. I'm looking for a new line of work.
Bramdel seemed to have changed his mind about Vrakas's injunction to protect humans from evil. In Hilchester, he had told Tungdil that he was carrying out the dwarf creator's wishes by executing human criminals. He considered them malignant, just as other dwarves held orcs to be evil.
In Trovegold?
Tungdil remembered the Freeling city, which lay in a high-vaulted mile-long cavern. He heard again how the mighty waterfalls thundered, and saw the gardens and the fortress where King Gemmel lived. He saw the dwarf priests praying, and heard the hymns they sang echoing away. It had been wonderful, the time he had spent there.
Going into trade, said Bramdel. If anyone knows how to make the equipment an executioner needs, it's me. Why shouldn't I use what I know? The kingdoms always need it, and we've always got the craftsmen.
Has anything changed in Trovegold?
Asked Tungdil rather sadly.
How long since you left?
It'll be quite a few cycles, I'm not quite sure.
But that was a lie. Tungdil knew exactly when he'd last seen Gemmel. It was 5 cycles ago.
Oh, a lot has changed. You'd hardly recognize the town. We've had to dig up the gardens to build workshops. The cave's been extended by a mile to make room for everyone.
So many children?
Not just that. The 5 free towns have grown in population. Trade with the dwarf realms has made the dwarf folk curious. It's not just the outcasts who come to us. Plenty turn up who want to get away from the clutches of their clans and their families.
Bramdel swiped at a bee that was buzzing around and investigating his jacket.
It's obvious why the advantages of our community appeal.
Not sure about advantages, grumbled Ireheart.
A dwarf needs stability.
He fell silent.
May they all achieve happiness, some in the mountains, some below the ground. It's a good way of life we have. Trade has brought prosperity.
Bramdel saw a crossroads.
Our paths split here. Did you know that Gemmel is dead?
No.
The news of the king's death affected Tungdil, and Boindil shook his head sadly too.
How?
Murdered. We think it was one of the Thirdlings. We caught a dwarf sneaking out of Trovegold, his clothes all covered in blood. He fought the guards like a berserker and killed 7 of them before they shot him down. We still have no idea why he did it.
To make trouble, Tungdil guessed. If he was one of the dwarf haters, he'll only have wanted to cause strife.
It's a terrible shame that the king who made me and my friends so welcome should die in that way.
Who succeeded him?
Gordislan Hammerfist.
Hammerfist?
Ireheart pricked up his ears.
Did he give himself that name? Or is he an exile from the clan?
Do you think it could be a relative of Bavragor Hammerfist? Tungdil conjured up the picture of the Secondling's best stonemason, a barrel of a dwarf strongly built with huge, calloused hands. He always wore an eye patch, and they called him the Singing Drunkard. He had shown his courage in countless battles at Tundal's side, and had died for the sake of the group fighting off the orcs at the Dragon's Breath Forge.